Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to this great edition of Carson's Corner, the MMA show. 7 years and counting, folks. 7 years of just sheer excellence right here on Carson's Corner. My name is Bob Carson. Glad to be with you here this Monday evening. We'll be joined momentarily by our co-host, Justin Ray Harvey. He should be calling in. He's going to be co-hosting this evening's show. And let's go to Justin right now. J-Ray, are you there?
Hey, Bob. How's it going?
Oh, good. Okay, great. So you can hear me. I can hear you fine. You're coming in loud and clear, so I'm assuming we are live and on the air.
Good, because this was the only way I could call in tonight, folks. Unfortunately, my battery is on the fritz tonight, so, yeah. Calling live from Skype.
Okay, that's great. That's a good start, to the show. And let me tell you, we got coming up for you today here, folks. In just about a minute or two, we're going to be reaching out to the American Soldier Bellator Tournament 5, I believe, Season 5 Tournament Champion, Eric Prindle. Eric Prindle is, let me tell you something, folks, he is one of the best human beings in the sport of mixed martial arts. Take my word for it. I've known Eric. I consider him a friend. He has a giant heart. He's a great family man. And he is a heavyweight fighter that can knock just about anybody out. And that's why people tune in to see heavyweight fights. They want to see big knockouts. They don't want to see someone like, well, I don't want to disparage him, but a guy like Cole Conrad, who was undefeated and the Bellator champion, he was a wrestler and took his opponents down and submitted them, and that's great and all. But I'll tell you, people really tune in to see heavyweights stand and bang. And that's what's great about Eric Prindle is he does that. He does that very, very well. And, he's going to be on the show. He's got a fight coming up. It's just we're always so excited to talk to Eric Prindle. He really is a great guy. And so we've got that coming up, and then we're going to get into an email update from Joan Quinn. Joan Quinn, the mother of Dan Quinn, actually sent me an email updating his case, and it really provides some specifics out there because a lot of people want to know what's going on with Dan's case. So I'm going to read you an email from Joan Quinn, and either before or after that, Justin and I are going to get into a little spat that we had with another radio host. If those of you who have been on the Underground Forum have seen me feuding with another host, and this goes back 2 years, and this is a very, very interesting story. It's resolved now, thank God.
At least we hope, Bob.
Yeah, that's right. And you know what? We're going to have to see what happens, but Justin and I are going to have to get some things off of our chest, and we'll get to that a little later on in the program. But without further ado, oh, and also we have the chat room open for you as well. We've got that open, so please feel free to chime in the chat room. But let's reach out to our good friend Eric Prindle now. Just bear with us here. We're going to be calling out to Eric.
Please enjoy ringback tone while your party is reached.
10% luck,
20% skill, 15%
concentrated power of will.
Hello. Eric, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. How's it going?
Oh, great, great. We can hear you loud and clear, and I want to welcome you back to the show. And also, I want to introduce you to my co-host for the evening, Justin Ray Harvey. Justin, meet the American Soldier, Bellator heavyweight champion, Eric Prindle.
It is
hey, how's it going?
Truly an honor to meet you, sir. A champion like yourself, it is truly an honor to meet you.
Oh, thank you. You too, guys.
Well, listen, Eric, we got a lot to talk about. Of course, your last fight with Peter Graham was very, very entertaining. And Justin, feel free during the course of the interview, if you have a question for Eric and whatnot, feel free to interject. But I want to get to what's going on with you and your fight on December 20th, I believe. I know that you were scheduled to fight Alexander Emelianenko, the brother of Fedor, and then that fight has been switched. Tell the audience what happened with that, if you would.
Basically, I believe Bellator kind of pre-approved me fighting in Russia, and then they matched me up with Alexander Emelianenko, and I put it up on the web, you know, on Facebook and Twitter, and I got a lot of responses saying that he had some disease and or whatnot. And I contacted Bellator, and Bellator looked into it, and I don't know exactly, you know, the whole whatever is going on, but Bellator said that I'm not going to be fighting them, that Alexander Emelianenko, for whatever reason, I'm not sure, but I'm going to be fighting in Russia, I believe, on the same night. So basically, they're switching my opponent.
Now, what promotion is this? Is this with M1 or no?
I'm not sure. I think it's M1 or a sister kind of promotion of that. I know they're working with Bellator, or something's going on. Bellator offered me this fight, and of course I want to fight anytime, anywhere. If it's not in Bellator cage, I would love to fight pretty much anywhere. But so they basically came to me, gave me this fight, and I said yes, and I'm raring to go. I just trained really hard, and I'm just aching to fight again and prove myself.
Well, you know what's odd is that I've only looked into this briefly, so I'm not really too informed on what happened with Alexander. I know he does have a reputation for having hepatitis B among some circles. I don't know if that's verified, but from my understanding, there was an absence of blood work, and he hasn't fought in the States in a number of years, because obviously in the athletic commissions in the States, you have to provide blood work for the examination of whoever's, you know, sanctioning the bout, and that didn't, you know, so now I guess it's always a risk fighting someone if you don't know whether or not they have a disease. So my question to you is, the new opponent that you have on December 20th, are you confident that the commissions in Russia, which apparently I guess have lax standards compared to what we have here in the United States, are going to put you in there with a fighter that, you know, doesn't have any type of diseases and whatnot?
Yeah, I'm confident. You know, I think they're trying to do the best job they can, and I know just like in the States and United States, they do the best job they can. So I believe, you know, Bellator is looking after me and
right.
All their fighters, I'm sure. So I think all around, I just can't wait to get there and fight and show the Russian people and the American people, you know, two guys going at war and just loving to fight and just love what they do, and hopefully, you know, we could have a great fight and the fans love it.
Yeah, you know, Alexander Emelianenko is basically your size, 6'6". I think he's got a record of 23-6, according to Sherdog. As I mentioned, has difficulty fighting in the States, but, you know, has fought, I think his last fight was versus Bob Sapp, for whatever that's worth, and he won via TKO. But a lot of people, were including myself, were looking into that fight. But on the other hand, it's good that Bellator is allowing you to fight for other promotions, which is something you don't see with UFC fighters. And it's good that they have the presence of mind to make sure that everything is okay medically. So when you do fight on the 20th, since Bellator is involved, and it sounds like you're pretty confident that they are putting you in a safe situation there. So that's good. Do you know anything about your new opponent, Eric?
No, not yet. I'm not sure. I'm just training every day for any contingency, and just, you know, when you love what you do, it's you just do the best you can, and I'm just gonna be ready for whatever comes, and hopefully I'll get the W. And I know no matter what, I'm gonna go in there, do what I want to do, and be in shape. So that's the bottom line.
When are you actually going to be heading to Russia?
I believe on the 19th.
Okay. And the fight
is on
the 20th?
Get there. 22nd, I believe.
Okay.
And I leave the 23rd.
Okay. All right, that's not that bad then, because there's at least some time for you to settle down in there and whatnot. Are you anticipating any problems in terms of your health or in terms of just fighting in another area of the world? I mean, I know I've heard some fighters that have said that depending upon the time zone, and there's a lot of different variables that can affect their performance and whatnot. Are you worried about any of that at all going into this fight?
Not really. You know, I've fought overseas a couple of times. I fought overseas while I was in the Army and boxing. And basically, you know what you got to do. Like, either you got to stay up or go to bed at a certain time so you can switch your clock over to whatever, you know, whatever time zone you're going to be in. That way, basically, I'm pretty pliable when it comes to, like, if I need to sleep or stay up or whatever. None of that's going to be any excuses for me if something, you know, doesn't go my way. I'm just going to train as the best I can and go in there and be have a great fight.
Yeah, I can't wait to see this, because we all saw your last fight with Peter Graham, and I know it didn't turn out the way that you wanted it to, but, you know, as I mentioned before we hooked up with you today for this interview, you have a tremendous amount of heart, and that is obviously something that comes out in the cage, and you like to stand there and either knock someone out or get knocked out. And Peter Graham was, you know, you knew that it was going to be a very tough fight going into it, because obviously he has a kickboxing background, and I believe he defeated Alexander Emelianenko, if I'm not mistaken, and it was really, really a good fight. It just seemed that you had difficulty just kind of landing on him. I don't know. That's what it seemed like from my perspective. Give us your thoughts on what happened in the fight.
Basically, through whatever reason, I went in there. I felt good the first couple of seconds. I don't know what was going on, but basically, I gassed out. Even before the first round was over, I gassed out, and the rest was heart, just sucking up and, you know, trying to have fun and whatever happened, you know. There was a point, I remember, I was throwing a punch, he hit me, I was up against the cage, and I think I was knocked out, basically just standing up. And then I woke up to getting hit again, and I was trying to punch him. And just for me, that's when I feel the most alive. And hopefully, I can have a long career and keep doing this and hopefully have some great fights for the fans and make some good money and support my family.
You mentioned that you felt fatigued and you felt gassed, and it definitely looked like that to the viewer at home. What was it that made you gassed? Have you basically pinpointed what exactly was it? Was it just, you know, nerves, or was it, you know, something in your diet, or what do you think that it was that really made you tired?
I don't know, honestly, no. I trained pretty well for it. Every time, you know, in sparring, and we would do 5-minute rounds for 5 rounds, and, you know, I would get tired, but not gas like that. I don't know what it was. I don't know if it was just, you know, you can't be on point every fight or what, but I definitely learned from the fight. I learned to conserve a little more energy if I am getting gas and not just kind of, you know, blow it all out there. And I think if I would have practiced some more takedowns, some different, and closed the distance a little quicker, that fight could have been, you know, gone my way. But Peter Graham's a great guy. He's a one hell, he's a great striker. I don't know if you guys saw the fight with him and
Chukwuka,
the black guy. Yeah, but
Chukwuka, yeah.
He didn't fight the same way he fought with me. I don't know why that was, or if Chukwuka's just, you know, a lot faster or what, but he didn't leg kick as much either, so I'm wondering what was going on with that. But his leg kicks are like a mule, I can tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Eric, I do have a question for you. Like, when you go to train for each of your fight, do you train differently for each fight per se, like for specifically to the fighter that you are facing, or do you basically try to train the same, or do you try to mix it up a little bit?
Usually, like say I'm fighting a real good wrestler, a good ground guy, and basically I, you know, try to keep my stand up as polished as I can, and then work on my ground game as much as possible, and work on the takedown defense and so that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it does change, you know. Say if I'm finding a great striker, then I try to work on the takedowns and you know, try to work on striking and different angles and fighting with angles and catch and return, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and going back to your fight with Peter Graham, it, folks, you know, I follow Eric on Facebook, and Eric trains very, very hard for each one of his fights. I mean, this is what you're doing on a full-time basis now. You have training partners like Alistair Overeem, and other individuals that, you know, are do this full time as well, and have achieved a certain amount of success in the sport. So it's really kind of a mystery. But, you know, hopefully you can learn something from the Peter Graham fight. And I just have to ask you, just as a heavyweight in Bellator, you've got Chukwuka versus Vitaly Minnikov, who was the tournament champion. I forget what season, but he defeated, of course, Alexander Volkov. And Vitaly Minnikov looks very, very impressive. He really does. But then again, Chukwuka, who has fought in the UFC, you know, probably two dozen, many times, who knows how many, the exact amount of times, that's for someone like, you know, one of these MMA journalists, so-called, who thinks that, you know, knowing how many times a fighter wins by armbar, how many times they fought in the UFC, actually means something. But in any event, Chukwuka has fought and beaten some good guys, and he's a really, really good heavyweight. What do you think that is going to happen in the fight? How do you think that's going to play out?
You know, from the last fight with Chukwuka, I think Chukwuka has somewhat of an upper hand, having more experience fighting, you know, bigger fights, that sort of thing. I think he's going to go in there feeling a little more confident. And being confident is a really big thing in MMA. If you're real confident, you know, you got a good head on your shoulders and you trained hard, it's a hard combination to beat. So I think, but I, you know, again, they're, they're both great fighters. I know it's going to be one hell of a war, but I think Chicago is going to win that.
Yeah, I would have to place the odds with him because he has the experience factor, and Minnikoff really hasn't fought that level of opponent yet. I mean, his fight with Alexander Volkov was very, very decisive. Then prior to that, he beat Ryan Martinez, again, very decisively. But with all due respect to those fighters, I don't think that they have fought the level of competition that Chuck Congo has fought. And so, you know, Chuck Congo would have to be the favorite to win that fight. So we'll just have to see what happens. When are you actually...
You know, if you watch that fight again with Chicago, with the guy that I fought, he actually turned up his striking. His punches were way faster. I mean, I think he's on point right now. Whoever he's going to fight next, it's going to be a long, hard fight for him. And I think Chicago is going to win just because of the simple fact that Chicago is, you know, like at his high point in his career, and he's feeling confident, and he's going to go out there and give the best fight possible and probably win.
Yeah, and he's no spring chicken either. I mean, in terms of MMA fights, I mean, he's probably approaching 38 years old, I think, maybe 39 years old, but he does seem to be finding a stride in Bellator, and I think that his striking is better than Minnikoff's.
I think so, too.
Yeah, and if Minnikoff is going to try to get him down to the ground, I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, I think he's going to go for broke trying to take him down, and I think Chicago's going to, you know, probably reverse it on him and pound him out. But I just wanted to say thank you to all my training partners helping me out for this fight. Ashley Gooch and Jordan Johnson, they've been helping me out a lot at the lab, and they're great guys. I just wish I could, you know, train with every heavyweight that's been cool training with me, and I just appreciate everybody helping me out.
When are you actually going to be fighting in Bellator next?
I'm not sure. I know Bellator's been pretty nice to me, and I think hopefully pretty soon, probably the first of the year, I'm hoping. You know, all I can do is hope and just wait for their call. And I can say thank you for Bellator for watching out for me and taking care of me for this, because this could have been pretty bad if the rumors are true and, you know, all that. I could have went over there, caught a disease and, you know, been in trouble. But I hope, you know, I hope whatever's wrong, he gets taken care of, and he has a good recovery.
Yeah, I, you know, it's, you always risk it. People always talk about the government and everything like that in the United States, and sometimes the government can be a punching bag for some, but we often take strong athletic commissions and the such regulation for granted, but we all depend on it, because I'll tell you, you don't, in the United States, you don't have to worry about that. I mean, you can always, you know, Tommy Morrison fought MMA on an Indian reservation, and, you know, we know that Tommy Morrison basically had AIDS and everything like that, but that won't happen in any athletic commission really in the States, and that's great that we have a safe sport in that sense. But you know what else, you know, you look at someone like, and I don't think that you look at the situation with Shane Del Rosario, and you know, it's impossible to say his passing had anything to do with the sport, and probably from what I've seen, he may have had some sort of heart condition that led to, you know, his passing. But you look at someone like...
What happened?
Shane Del Rosario just passed away today.
What the hell? The guy from California?
Yeah, he had a heart attack the Thursday before, and they put him on life support. There was no brain activity. I forget the exact medical term, but he had
I trained with him at CSW a bunch of times. He was a great dude.
Yeah, he was.
His stand-up was pretty good.
Yeah, he was really, really, really good guy. I mean, everybody liked Shane Del Rosario, former football player. He fought in Strikeforce, beat LeVar Johnson in Strikeforce, and then I think he got signed to the UFC and didn't do too well in the UFC. He lost to Stipe his last fight, and before that, I think he lost to Pat Barry, or the order may be reversed. But he was nonetheless a good heavyweight fighter and really all around guy. And he's dead at the age of 30 because of this. He may have had a heart condition that is very rare and affects athletes, young athletes. But the point I'm trying to make here is that the uncertainty with the sport of MMA is that, I think it was even Ronda Rousey, and I'm not a fan of her, but she occasionally makes some good points where she said, in a split second, you could be dead or you could be incapacitated and whatnot. And it just goes to show you just the tremendous amount of risk that fighters take just from competing in the sport itself, let alone, going to other countries and fighting for promotions in areas that do not have any athletic commissions and certainly don't care about the welfare of the fighters. So, and then, you throw into, hold on, just I'll let you talk. You throw into the mix Gary Goodridge, someone, I believe it's Gary Goodridge, that now has dementia. Really, really sad situation, but we just don't know the effects on MMA fighters, and we may not know until several decades down the line. God, Justin, I'm sorry.
I was going to say two quick things here, Bob. I was going to say that's why I've always said, life is short. Enjoy your life while you're here on Earth, and just do the best you can because you never know when it's gone in a blink of an eye. And I was gonna ask Eric Prindle, what is your expectations for your next fight that's coming up?
What is my expectations for my next fight?
Yes.
Hopefully it's going to be a great, hard fight. I'm going to hit him hard and all the time and hopefully knock him out or submit him and win the fight and go home and see my family. I wanted to say one thing. Everybody or a lot of people talk about, boxing or MMA, that's a brutal sport. I know growing up, getting in a lot of fights and whatever, I think MMA is going to help a lot of people. It teaches you discipline. You kind of have a self-worth. You feel good about yourself when you're learning. And I think the damage it does do to bodies, brain damage, broken limbs or whatever, far is no comparison to the good it's going to do. So I think, people worrying about, we're not going to know the fighters in 15 years, 20 years down the road, all the damage is going to happen and all that, but I think you can ask any MMA fighter, would they rather, fight and know they're going to be, have dementia or whatever 15, 20 years from now? I bet you pretty much any fighter would rather keep fighting as long as possible because it makes them happy. They love what they do and they're going to do it. Just like, anybody else, whatever, a pilot's going to, they love flying, they're going to do it.
Yeah.
They could wreck and crash, but at the same time, they're going to fly because they love it,
Yeah.
So I think,
absolutely.
I think, I think it's MMA is a great thing, and the good stuff by far outweighs the negatives, and it's definitely helped my life out a lot. You know, being at war and everything that I've done in the Army, PTSD is definitely a lot easier to handle when you're training every day and, you know, you're focusing on learning and doing everything you can to get better, mm-hmm. and in turn, you get better inside. So I think it's a good thing.
You know,
absolutely.
And to add to your point, Eric, is that you're probably right, is that, you know, fighters understand the risk. Fighters are not stupid. They know that they're getting hit in the head, okay? Their opponent is deliberately... It's legalized violence, okay? And violence has its risks. And you know something? I mean, the fact of the matter is that not everybody that does MMA, even if it is proven that, you know, MMA fighters or head trauma... can lead to dementia, which, you know, I think certainly we could say that it is proven, although, you know,
there's
for
a
years,
correlation for it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. For years, I mean, the tobacco industry, you know, there was an argument as to whether or not smoking causes cancer. Well, now you can't buy a pack of cigarettes without any type of a warning on it that smoking may cause cancer. And it's the same thing with MMA, but with smoking, only about 10% or 20% of smokers actually develop cancer. And the same would probably apply to MMA fighters, where, yeah, you know, you're more likely to get brain damage, you're more likely to suffer some sort of effects, but it doesn't necessarily automatically mean it's going to take place. And so therefore... You know, how far do we go in regulating the sport? Do we have fighters wear headgear? Is that where we're going? You know, what type of precautions do they take? The officials, when it becomes more clear that there is some sort of correlation between, you know, head trauma and dementia and whatnot. I mean, these are all questions that are going to be answered eventually. We may not be alive when they're answered. I mean, some say we're in the dark ages of MMA, and I think there's a lot of truth to that. But, you know, yeah, I think you're absolutely right, is that fighters take the risk, and they understand, and they whatever happens, they'll have to deal with it. You know, it's just a question of, my concern is just the economic welfare of these fighters, where, you know, yeah, they'll take the risk, and they understand that, and they'll live with it, but, you know, years down the line, what's going to happen to them economically? Because if you look at what happened with the NFL players, where the NFL players, you know, a whole bunch of them got together. Yeah, and they sued the NFL because they had medical problems. They had all these different, you know, financial problems associated with head trauma that they got from playing in the National Football League, and you know, it's, you know, who's benefiting from all this stuff. So that's my my concern. But you know what, the sport is great, and I don't want to see too many changes to it, although there always can be changes to anything as it goes on.
Yeah, well, you look at boxing's been around for a long time. And, you know, there's been a lot more deaths contributing to boxing. I don't think there's been any deaths in the MMA cage.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think in actuality, MMA is safer than boxing because you don't get strikes. You get a standing eight, you know, you get a little recover a little bit, and then you get pounded on some more. At least with MMA, you know, you get pounded out or you get dropped, someone arm bars you or whatever. To me, it's a lot more safer. You might have more body injuries, but like you said, or like I believe at least, your body can be injured, but your brain, you know, you need to keep your brain intact as much as possible. That's why I've been trying to work on a lot more defense and not just using my head as part of the defense and, you know, getting hit and try to hit back. So I want to have as long as career as possible and as good as career as possible and make a legacy out of this and hopefully make some good money and, you know, take care of my family.
You know, your point is well taken, Justin. I'm going to let you respond. But I read a while ago, and I can't quote the source, but over 50 boxers have died since the 1990s. And in MMA that I'm aware of, there was a Sammy Vasquez case in Texas where he was killed. He died of a brain aneurysm, I believe, because, and I'm just kind of going off memory here, so I apologize if the exact circumstances are inaccurate, but I believe that his head hit some sort of exposed metal in the cage, and that contributed to his death. And then there was the double
edge. Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, and that's just what that is it, that looks like, if I'm not mistaken, that looks like, you know, poor planning, poor execution on the part of the commission that sanctioned this bout. And then there was the Doug Dedge case, and Eddie Goldman can tell everybody more about that, because Doug Dedge actually emailed Eddie and asked Eddie what his opinion was about fighting overseas in MMA events, and then Doug Dedge winds up getting killed or losing his life after an MMA bout. But your point is well taken. But another thing, too, in MMA, and John Peretti spoke about this. John Peretti, of course, the original UFC matchmaker, he spoke about the anvil effect, how when a fighter is down and they're getting hit, there's two impacts. There's the fighter getting hit. You know, say if a fighter is mounted, getting punched, there's that impact, and it's a fighter hitting the head, hitting his head on the canvas, and that could be really damaging in terms of long-term effects. But the point is, we're not seeing guys dying in MMA matches, which is a clear indication that boxing is more dangerous than MMA. But you know,
I agree. Mm-hmm. I've done both. I boxed at you know international level, and I definitely, I had some wars. I was fighting in the CISM. It's a World Military Games, and I was fighting a Russian. Actually, I think that was either in Russia or that was in Ireland. And we had a war, and I'll tell you what, I probably got hit more in that fight than I will my whole MMA career. And
yeah.
I know for a fact that MMA is a lot safer than boxing. Even though I love boxing, but that's the facts.
Yeah,
in my opinion.
I agree with you. I don't think really anybody can argue that at this point. Nonetheless, you'll probably have some people out there that would try to make that argument. But Justin, you were going to say something.
I was going to say something that I agree with Eric Prindle, because a prime example would be, look at Muhammad Ali, one of the greatest boxers of all time. I believe the reason for his Parkinson's disease is, you know, his boxing career and having been hit so many times can really, you know, take a toll on you. So.
And Jerry Quarry, too. I mean, oh, God. Jerry Quarry was, if you go on YouTube and you look up Jerry Quarry, he was an absolute mess right around the time that he died. He died, I think, at a very a relatively young age, maybe in his 50s, and his condition was directly related to boxing. And yeah, Muhammad Ali, again, condition directly related to boxing. And if you look at Joe Frazier, even before Joe Frazier died, you couldn't understand him. Riddick Bowe, a younger heavyweight fighter. You could look at interviews that Riddick Bowe did years ago versus today,
mm-hmm.
and you could definitely hear an effect. And I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And it's
I could tell you one thing real quick. I can guarantee if all those guys could go back and do it, they would do it exactly the same because they love what they were doing.
Yeah.
So we could talk about, you know, all the bad stuff about it. I think we should be more positive, and I understand there's risk and everything. You know, you could be driving down the road and die in a car accident, so are we all going to stop driving? You know, I doubt it, but I just, it kind of, it kind of gets me not upset, but a little perturbed when everybody's thinking about the negative stuff about it. We should be concentrating, especially, you know, being fans and all that. We should be happy, and I definitely understand what the heck is that? Understand about being, you know, cautious and taking care of everything, but always talking about the negative stuff isn't a good thing, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, these fighters are absolutely amazing, and that's why we do the show. Is I love the MMA fighters, and I used to do this myself too. I mean, I was an embarrassment as a fighter, but you know, I know what it's like to go in there and get hit and everything, and people love the sport. There's no, even someone like Dana White, who I often disagree with and I often criticize, nobody questions whether or not Dana White loves the sport. You know, it's just, I question certain business activities of his, mm-hmm. but, you know, that's another discussion for another time and whatnot.
That's a whole other show.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I wanted to get an update on our good friend Shannon the Cannon. It's been a while since we had him on the show, and he actually called me, I think, a couple weeks ago, and I couldn't answer it because I didn't have any service where I'm at now. But can you give us an update on how Shannon's doing?
Yeah, we actually just talked right before training. He's doing great. He's won, I think, his eighth or ninth straight this year. Mm-hmm. He's doing awesome. I think he's going to go fight in Mexico coming up here pretty soon, and then and that's one of his belts that he has. He's defending it. And then I believe one in Canada, he's defending his belt there. I know he has, like, several belts. He's doing awesome this year. I could tell you, he knows a lot of MMA. He knows, you know, he's well-rounded. With him, all it is confidence. If he's confident and he goes in there in shape, he's going to beat the guy. So I just hope he keeps staying confident, goes in shape, and, you know, wins the fights. He's a great guy. He's helped me out so much. He was actually going to go with me to Russia, but some logistical problems happened, came up, and he wasn't able to go. But I wish he could have went with me. I hope. You know, he's doing great. Him and his wife are doing great, and I think he's getting ready to go to Las Vegas right now to go train with a bunch of guys in Vegas and then go to his wife's Christmas party or something like that there in Vegas.
Was he with you in Oklahoma when you fought Peter Graham?
Yes, he was. He cornered me, him and my friend Eaton. He's a movie star guy. He was on that TV show where the serial killer, what's the name
Dexter?
Of it? Yeah, he was on Dexter and a bunch of other shows, CSI and all that. But he was with me, helped me. They're great guys. I wish Shannon Rich could corner me every time.
Yeah, well, you guys are very close. And yet Shannon has helped this show out in the past. He's helped us out with guests and so on. I definitely consider him a friend, no question about that. Justin, you have any
questions? Shannon Rich is the next matchmaker for King of the Cage now.
Right.
So if anybody wants a fight, call Shannon Rich.
Absolutely. Justin, you have any questions? Because we're going to kind of wrap it up here in a minute or so.
Actually, I just wanted to tell Eric Prindle that it has been an honor to interview you today. And I have a radio show, and I would love to have you as a guest sometime. And good luck in Russia.
Oh, thank you very much. You too. God bless, and you guys be safe. I wanted to say thank you to all my sponsors and my friends Jason Wise, Shannon Rich, Ashley Gooch, Jordan Johnson, all the guys that are helping me train, the lab, Eric Polson, CSW, Josh Barnett, all those guys. They're all awesome. you know, I talk about me being in the Army and the camaraderie. I think that's another reason why I do MMA, is because MMA gives me that camaraderie, and you feel like you belong, and you're with your friends, your blood, sweat, and tears, and there's no other thing like it. And thank God I'm allowed to do it, and I just can't wait to get in the cage again and have a great fight and win, get a good knockout or a good submission and go home and see my kids.
Well, Eric, again, we really wish you the best of luck. You, I think, are a great example of what an MMA fighter should be. You carry yourself with such respect and such class, respect for the opponent and everything. And all of these positive attributes when it comes to what mixed martial arts can do for everybody, I think you kind of show. We wish you the best of luck, and hopefully we'll talk to you sometime soon down the road.
Oh, anytime. Anytime.
Absolutely.
If you want to look me up, it's ericprindle.com or on Facebook. Thank you, guys.
Take care,
brother.
Thank
you, Eric.
God bless you guys. Be safe. Bye.
You too, my friend.
You too, but happy holidays, brother.
I tell
All right,
you,
that
boss,
was Eric Prindle.
Guy right there.
Yeah,
right
I'm
there.
Telling you, I knew that you'd be an even bigger fan after we interviewed him. You got a friend of him on Facebook. And,
I'm
going to
do that.
Keep in contact with him because he'll definitely come on your show. And you know, Eric is a guy that everybody roots for. You know, he really has a tremendous amount of heart, always has respect for his opponents and everybody. And, it's a pleasure watching him fight and being his friend. It really is. I think we'll always have Eric on the show because we're always interested in what he's doing. But I just like talking to Eric because he's a real down-to-earth guy. And, you know, I could – if Eric were a champion in the UFC or if he was a high-level fighter in the UFC and he was doing interviews with, you know, some of these corporate mainstream – sites or shows like, you know, Yahoo or this and that or ESPN. I know, I guarantee Eric would probably contact me before he would even consider doing those shows because that's just what type of guy he is. He's really true to his roots. And that's more than I can say for a lot of fighters out there that I've dealt with over the year. Not a lot, but a decent percentage of fighters that I've dealt with over the years. You know, Justin?
Absolutely, Bob. I mean, it's just amazing. Me and you both, my friend, are making some great friends with some great fighters. So,
yes.
It's awesome.
Well, you just made another friend here tonight. We're going to take a commercial break here. We're going to be back in about 2.5 minutes or so. Justin and I got a lot more to cover here on Carson's Corner, so keep it right here, ladies and gentlemen. And in the meantime, this is letting you know of a show that we've got coming up tomorrow. It's a special edition of Carson's Corner dealing with missing and exploited children. Yep, and David Levitt is going to be joining us. He represents Speaker Mind Radio, and we're going to have a big show tomorrow. And this is the promo for this show tomorrow at 6 p.m. So if you want to do your part and help out and help raise awareness to find missing and abducted children and adults, this is the show to tune into. So we're going to be back in about 3 minutes or so, folks. Keep it right here on Carson's Corner with Bob Carson and Jay Ray.
Do exactly as you're told and no one gets hurt. Do you understand?
Hey, good evening, my Facebook followers, Twitter followers, and Voicemail followers. I want to let you know to tune in to Speak Your Mind Radio in conjunction with Carson's Corner and J-Ray Radio tomorrow night on Blog Talk Radio at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 5 Central, 4 p.m. Mountain, and 3 p.m. Pacific. To hear two family stories that is going to infuriate you, educate you, and make you question many things. In our first hour, our guest will be Stacy White, the sister-in-law of Tabitha Lynn Franklin. Tabitha, known as Tabby, has three children who have wakened four Christmases now in a row. This year will make five without their mother. Tabby went missing on August 13, 2009. She was last seen by her abusive ex-boyfriend, Chris Poor Merrill, who made a statement via telephone to Randy Frost, who was a lead detective, that he picked Tabby up from a friend's house, which was never searched, and took her to his business that wasn't searched until 3 months after Tabby went missing in Hueytown, Alabama. And when he returned from doing some errands, Tabitha was gone. When asked to come into the sheriff's office to make a formal statement, he refused, stating he was hiring a lawyer. To this day, Chris has not been questioned, and Stacy will tell us about her journey in fighting to find her sister-in-law and bring in the person responsible for her disappearance to justice. In the second hour, we will be joined by the parents of Phoenix Colden. Now, back in December of 2011, two African-American women with beautiful, bright faces and smiles went missing only 9 days apart. One was Phoenix Colden from Spanish Lake in St. Louis County, Missouri, on December 18, 2011. And then Stacy English from Atlanta, Georgia, on December 26 of the same year, whose body was found several weeks later. The media did report a possible connection between Phoenix and Stacy English, because in both cases, their cars were found with the engine still running. Also in both cases, the investigation was slowed down because the cars the women were driving had been impounded, a fact that neither police department realized until several days into the investigations. The similarities with these two cases in some eyes may show some signs of Phoenix possibly being grabbed for the use of human and sex trafficking or the drug trade. However, the Coldens still preferred not to link their daughter to the disappearance and death of Stacy English, and they do have a strong, firm belief, as well as I do, that Phoenix is still alive and is not being allowed to contact them or to come home. So please, again, join us tomorrow night on Blog Talk Radio, and the link will be in the description below.
Does anybody see me? Does anybody know who I am?
All right, we're back here on Carson's Corner, and the link so that you can listen to the show tomorrow is blogtalkradio.com/Carson's Corner. That's blogtalkradio.com/Carson's Corner. Let's bring back our co-host for the evening, Justin Ray Harvey, J. Ray. J. Ray, how are you, my friend?
I am having a blast, Bob. It's good to be back, even though my health is still not the best. It's wonderful to be back on Carson's Corner.
Didn't I tell you that you're going to have fun today, man?
Oh, I'm having a blast, Bob. And if you don't mind, if I could give your audience a huge update on what I've been doing, if you don't mind, Bob.
Sure.
Here soon on Carson's Corner, guys, I'm going to be playing you guys an interview of Michelle Kesey, the guy that played Tom Poe in the Kickboxer series, and I've also interviewed David Wirth, the director of Kickboxer, and, you know, some of the actors from Kickboxer. And it's pretty big stuff, right, Bob?
Yeah, in fact, we played the David Wirth interview. I think, I forget what show we played that on. You could scroll back and go back to a few shows ago. And the entire, I think it was the it was the second Dan Quinn update, and for the second hour we played the David Wirth interview. That's the director of Kickbox that Justin interviewed, and that's available on this channel. And so, yeah, you know, this is very nostalgic because these fights or these movies were very, very instrumental in films in the 80s. I mean, of course, you had Bloodsport in 1989, and everybody remembers those films, and everybody remembers the villains in those films and everything, how, you know, they really stood out. And even though, you know, nowadays you don't see that in films. You don't see those type of villains anymore. You see basically a recycling of actors, you know, in films, but you don't have, like, you know, a Tong Po, Michelle Kesey, or Bolo Young, or, you know, those guys, they were not real name actors. They weren't, you know, at the level of Jean-Claude Van Damme, but they were great villains. They really stood out, and they really made those films and everything.
Yeah, Bob. And like I said, that's why I've been wanting to document this for years, because I want to bring something back that's, you know, classic and something good for our listeners. So in a few weeks, I will be playing that interview. Right now, Michelle Kesey is in Morocco working on a film right now called The Pact. So.
Yeah. What is that in the background? Is that like a dog or something?
That's my dog trying to play. I'm taking her toy from her so she can't do that, Bob.
Sounds like a squeaky blackboard or like a markers on a blackboard or something like that you'd hear in a classroom. But, we got a lot more to talk about. We've got David Levitt on the line. We're going to get to him a little later. He's going to be co-hosting this show tomorrow that you heard about, with two missing family members of two individuals that are missing. And that's something that we do here on Carson's Corner. It's part of Carson's Corner, and it's very, very important. You know, you'll recall three Ohio women were found last year. I think it was May 5th, 2000, or earlier this year, actually. Wow. I'll tell you, time flies by. May 5th, 2013, I believe it was, when three Ohio women that were missing for a long period of time, one of which, Amanda Berry, was missing for 10 years, they were found in this guy Ariel Castro's home. And Ariel Castro was one of the most evil men that you can imagine. He recently hung himself in jail, but not for the purposes that you and I would hope that he would hang himself for.
Yeah.
It appears that he was hanging himself for pleasure, which is really disgusting. But actually, one of the ladies, Nancy Ruiz, I believe, who was the mother of Gina DeJesus, actually called in on the show last year, and a year later they find her daughter in Ohio in the House of Horrors. And it just goes to show you that you never know who's going to call Carson's Corner, and you never know who's listening out there. It's we're doing our part to raise awareness to missing and abducted adults and children. And David Levitt, to just take my hat off to him, does a lot of work. This is basically his life. He puts a lot of passion into these cases and works with the families and everything. And he contacts me, and we put him on the air. So we'll be checking in with David in just a little while. But Justin and I have to talk about something that transpired over the weekend, and I'm going to kind of set this up. I'm going to really provide the context for why I think I was attacked on the forums, and we'll get Justin's take on it and everything like that. And after that, if we still have time, I want to read to you an email that Joan Quinn sent to me, updating me about Dan Quinn's trial. It's very, very important. Hopefully we'll get to it. We have about 30 minutes left, but this show, Carson's Corner, was on cagejunkies.com, and Charles McCarthy, who was a UFC veteran, he runs his own school as part of American Top Team, I believe, and Charles McCarthy was on one of the early seasons of The Ultimate Fighter. And, you know, he's been a long-time friend of the program. We've had him on in 2008, and we've had him on several times since then. He launched this website, cagejunkies.com, and mm-hmm. Carson's Corner was a part of it. He asked us to go on the show or go on the website, and we did, and we provided them content, and they wrote us a great article on the website. In fact, it was Jay Pagliaro, I believe, that actually wrote the article, expressing how, you know, it was such an honor to be affiliated with Carson's Corner and all this stuff. And so, okay, you know, I went on Jay's show in September of 2011, and I had corresponded with Jay and had no problems with him. I mean, you know, I wasn't really familiar with his show before the launch of CageJunkies.com, but, you know, he treated me with respect, and that was it. You know, we had a good relationship. And then I think it was December of 2011, almost 2 years ago, Justin called in to the program, and mm-hmm. he wanted to make a point about steroids. And then right off the bat, they just started really insulting Justin. I mean, just the things that they were saying about him were vile, very hurtful. And I remember that day like it was yesterday, because Justin called me up after this happened. I think it was, you know, sometime around 9, 10 o'clock, and I was living at my sister's at the time, and Justin was in tears based on what happened and everything like that. And I went back and I listened to it, and, you know, it was really, really bad how it was handled and everything like that. And I didn't really, you know, make an issue out of it. Justin responded, and Frank Dukes, who also was attacked during that call, responded. Mm-hmm. I think that they were, Frank was going to do some sort of video or something like that, but they definitely responded. And those individuals supposedly received a lot of hate mail for what happened, and
which they should have, honestly, Bob, for what they did. Yeah.
And so I kind of kept my distance away from them at that point, because, you know, I'd seen Jay sometimes on Facebook, and he would sort of get into these wars with people and start, you know, flaming people and all that stuff. And I said, you know what? I'm not going to really get involved with that, because I've done that before. I you know, back in 2006 when I first started the show, I really did a lot of things I shouldn't have online. I insulted a lot of people, a lot of fighters, mm-hmm. and I can give you examples. Tate Fletcher, of one of the I think he's retired now, but Tate Fletcher actually threatened to kill me online, and rightfully so. Rory Singer, I called him the Florence Nightingale of MMA. I made fun of his nursing. I mean, I could just go on and on and on. And,
yeah.
You know, it caught up with me. And a lot of people flamed me, rightfully so, for my online activity. And so we've really matured over the years. And so this guy, Dan the Wolfman, he's a former fighter, stuntman, actor, and internet personality, and Dan the Wolfman appeared on the show in May of 2011, I believe, and he friended me on Facebook a couple weeks ago. I'm like, oh, great, Dan, we have to get you on the show. And it just so happened that Dan was involved in some controversy on the Underground. He was banned for posting videos on the Underground on somebody else's thread, and he got into a feud with a moderator on there. And we were going to have Dan on the show. Dan agreed to come on the show. And then I announced it on Facebook, and then the thing started to heat up between him and this moderator. And Dan's like, listen, I'm not sure if I want to elevate this. I don't want to come on the show. So we postponed then everything. And at the same time, my producer on the Underground Forum was mm-hmm. responding to this moderator, and Jay Pagliaro of Pull No Punches Radio started insulting me and insulting the show. And he said something.
Insulting me again. Yeah,
yeah, I'm going to get to that, yeah. Mm-hmm. Something to the effect that the show was a joke, or it's the armpit of MMA radio or something like that. And I responded something to the effect that, Yeah, well, we haven't reduced ourselves to making fun of somebody with cerebral palsy, but then again, you know, we can always work our way up. I was obviously referring to what happened between them and Justin Ray Harvey in 2011. And then from there, you know, he posted, you know, your dumbass friend called trolling, and we called him on his bluff, and, you know, we basically, you know, gave him what he deserved and everything like that. And it just kind of, you know, Jay and I went back and forth. He posted, he actually posted something on Facebook, let's shoot Bob Carson. And I posted that on my Facebook page. I'm like, you know, is that a threat? What should we do? You know, should I call the cops? Which I wasn't going to call the cops anyway, because Jay lives in Arizona, and I don't think it was an imminent threat and whatnot. But a lot, everybody said, yeah, I would have called the cops and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And to make a long story short, which is probably too late by now, Jay actually sort of in a way apologized yesterday, said, you know, he regrets how we handled the situation. He claims he didn't know that you were disabled at the time, and you know, if his words offended you, then he apologized. And I didn't respond after that because I don't have time for this stuff. I'm a very busy person. But you know, that was it. It's like, you know, I could go on and on and on about comparing my show to his show and what we've done over the past 7-8 years, but it doesn't matter, because in one of my posts I said, Jay, listen, you know, I don't think you're a bad guy. It's nothing personal. And still, to this day, I have nothing personal against him. I don't hate Jay any of those guys. But what I said was, you know, I think what you did to Justin was wrong, and I think on some level you regret it. And you know what? Obviously he does on some level regret it, or else he wouldn't have said that. So.
Well, two things, Bob. It's a good thing that he said that, because I came close to speaking to an attorney about what I could do for a cease and desist on their,
right.
You know, with what he's doing. And what's sad, Bob, is me and Jay could have probably worked together and done big things. And I think the reason why he was trying to attack us, this is just my opinion, this is hearsay, I think he was really looking for ratings for his radio show, because whether people like it or not, when I was attacked, that was like one of the hottest things on the internet. I mean, it went all over Facebook, Twitter, you know, MySpace even. So I think he was kind of looking for ratings, trying to attack us with, you know, attack us because maybe he's looking for ratings, something to talk about on his radio show.
Well, you know, it all started with, like, you know, recently an attack on this show. And yeah, I mean, I you know, he's friends with the moderator that's having a feud with Dan the Wolfman. They're very tight and everything. And so, you know, my producer posts under my name, under Carson's Corner, the pro account on the Underground. He probably saw that and then, you know, insulted my show. And then, you know, we kind of went back and forth, but it's over now. But, you know, I just think that this is what happens with some people, where the internet often makes people just act stupid, and you know, you could throw me into that mix. At least, you know, previously in my life, I don't really troll that much anymore. I don't really have time to get into. But the reality is that people say things and type things on the internet because it oftentimes has no consequence to them, and so that they could be obnoxious. They could do this and they could do that. And some other people that perhaps don't have anything more to do with themselves, because let me tell you, there are people that spend all day on the forums. There are people, this is what they do with their lives. Maybe, you know, it helps them pass the time or whatever. There are people out there. And I just think that sometimes it just brings out the worst in people and whatnot.
Exactly, Bob, and despite what I think of Jay, I do wish Jay Pagliara the best, and I hope that he has at least learned a valuable lesson from this, because Because like I said, once people get to know me, people just love me to death, and I can do big things with different people. It's just that, you know, I think that Jay just got ahead of himself, and because I even had mentioned back when I was attacked 2 years ago that I knew you really well. So, and that just went over his head.
Well, that's the question I have is whether or not they knew that you had cerebral palsy, because you know, you had posted a bunch of times, I believe, about their show and everything. You posted on the Cage Junkies site. You definitely followed. So it's anybody's guess as to whether or not they knew that you really did. I would like to think, and I'm sure that most people out there would agree, that if they knew for sure that you do have this condition, that they wouldn't have treated you the way that they did. But who knows? I don't know. But in any event, it's like firing a shot, a warning shot. Well, I fired a warning shot and it landed on somebody, hit somebody. Well, you know, I didn't mean to do that, but, you know, The result was is that I injured a person. So that's the result of what he did, is whether or not they knew we could, you know, I don't know. Perhaps maybe they did know that you had cerebral palsy. I don't think they're bad guys. I don't think Marcus Davis is a bad guy. He's got children. You know, Jay has children. They're not evil friggin' people that want to malign someone that has a disability.
Yeah, I do think that they do know that I had CP at the time, Bob, but they just would not retract anything they said on the radio show, and they just wanted to keep things going, you know, to make sure that they didn't look to look bad. I think that they knew that I had CP, and now if they would have retracted what they said on the radio show and said, hey, we messed up, we apologize, then everything would have been fine.
Well, you know, and that's what I'm saying, is that if they, regardless of whether or not they knew, I mean, we could argue that maybe they did, maybe they didn't, I don't know. But the point that I was trying to make is that the result was is that they made fun of someone that really is disabled, that, you know, has a disability through no fault of his own, and it's that act in itself, whether intended or unintended, is what caused the harm, and they regret that. I mean, you know, obviously he wouldn't have posted that. They regret that at the time, and you know, he has to save face in a way on the forums. You know, he can't come out totally and say that, but you know, at the end of the day, that's it. You know, I move on. I said what I needed to say, because I still had a lot of feelings about the 2011 incident, and I never, because I'm generally a pessimist. I don't like to have any type of drama going on. You know, I'm basically a very passive individual. But you know, sometimes you have to say what's right. You have to stand up for what's right. And they treated you bad. It really bothered you. I know that you were very upset by it, and that was wrong. And so, you know, I'm sure all of us can move on. Hopefully we can all move on as better people.
Yeah, I had moved on, Bob, but this whole attack thing had come up, and we're like, okay, you know, what's going on? Because it's been 2 years, you know?
Yeah.
And then we see this on the forum. Just all of a sudden, you know.
Yes.
I had forgotten about it, and you had forgotten about it, and then just all of a sudden. So let's just hope that me, you, and Jay, and Mr. Davis can just live in peace. That's all I want. I want to be left alone. I don't want to be discredited. I don't want to be disrespected, and I know that they don't either. So let's just, you know, put it to rest, people.
Yeah, absolutely. And believe me, I could have really prolonged the issue if I wanted to, but like I said, I'm not trying to get involved with any type of internet spat. It's the last. I just don't have time for it. Nobody has time for it. You know, if I told you all the stuff that I have to do, I'm a full-time student. I work full-time. I've got this show. I've got my political show. I've got so much stuff. going on. I don't have time to sit on the forum and argue with somebody and insult somebody. I really don't. And I'll defend this show, too, because we've been doing it for a long time, and this show does not go unnoticed. And I can give you example after example how we've broken news items within the world of MMA, how we've been featured. I was even mentioned in a book, you know, so I can go on and on and on about our contributions to the sport of mixed martial arts. But it's a dead issue, and I want to move on. We're going to go to David Levitt, but before I do, I want to just read an email from Joan Quinn about Dan Quinn's case, and this is very important. And I'm not going to mention any names here because I don't want any type of lawsuits here.
Yeah.
Exactly. But I'm going to read you an update here. This is a letter that Joan Quinn wrote to, I believe, one of the public defenders or one of the attorneys or something to that effect. Thank you for speaking to me and being willing to read the documents I attached, which show, number one, my son, grandsons, and I were terrorized by threatening telephone calls. Many places were allegedly called and threatened by my son, University of Notre Dame, Congregation of Beth Shalom, Costco, Uptown Studios, various University of California campuses, a veterinarian, the Elks Grove PD, perhaps Rockland PD. Taped copies of these threats existed, which clearly show the caller was not my son. Police refused to investigate. Police harassed my son, and police harassment of my son, and to much lesser extent me. Public defender has all info needed for Dan's defense, but almost over 16 months changed his assigned attorney three times, refused to examine the tape made at his arrest, which would establish that arresting officer bragged to Dan that he had been one of the officers searching Dan's home / car on numerous occasions and would establish that Dan did not threaten the officer. I would be willing to swear to that public defender, blank, blank. Dave, the public defender told me at first examination of the tape was not necessary as there was the testimony of the arresting officer at Dan's prelim, which the tape would refute. He then told me I should pay for examination of the tape and denied that the public defender told my son that the tape had been altered. My son, Dan Quinn, has been in jail for almost 16 months with no trial. Blank, blank was assigned to Dan's case for about a year, then blank, blank for several months, then recently blank, blank supervisor. So three public defenders were assigned to Dan Quinn's case. This public defender knew very early on that Dan was diagnosed with bipolar. He was getting meds in jail. Can prove this by a letter I sent her. She never raised an issue of competence. Then, 15 months along, blank, blank takes over the case and immediately raises the issue of competence. I don't think that he even spoke to Dan, referring to the psychiatrist or the public defender. Dan was seen by a psychiatrist, name unknown. Did this psychiatrist find Dan Quinn competent? Dan was seen by a second psychiatrist, whose name I'm not going to mention, who spoke to me. I told them my background, that I had experience conducting W&I 5250 hearings, was familiar with the issue of competence. Dan understood the charges against him and would be able to cooperate preparing during this trial. All the information that is needed for a trial was already in the possession of the public defender. At the PC 1368 hearing, December 2nd, Dr. Schaefer, that's a matter of public record, found Dan to be incompetent. How fortuitous for the other public defender. No trouble, no trial. No work to subpoena witnesses and documents. Dan told me last night that his second psychiatrist asked him if he was willing to take a deal. Dan wants to go to trial. So when is a defendant's willingness to take a deal relevant to a competence to stand trial? If he's not competent to stand trial, how could he be made competent to take a deal? This question raises a real issue of the psychiatrist's, the second psychiatrist's, impartiality. I think you might enjoy this case. Okay. And then it just goes on to talk about some of the threats. Riley Prysock had recorded threats, you know, mentions Dan's article on TMZ.com and all that stuff. So that's basically an update from Joan Quinn's perspective.
Hey, Bob, which brings me to my which brings me to a good point. If they have voice on record, why couldn't they take it to like a forensics that could do like a voice type matching type thing that they can do nowadays, where they can match people's voices to make sure if or not if it was Dan Quinn or not.
That's really the voice recordings and everything like that is what prompted Dan to get a gun, and that's why he was in possession of a firearm. I mean, nobody is really contending that Dan made these calls. What they're saying is that these calls led to Dan getting a firearm. They were harassing, and they're all part of a effort to really put fear in the minds of Dan and his mother. And so, you know, anybody can listen to the TMZ call or the call that TMZ played and all that stuff, and they realize that that's not Dan's voice. What's more interesting is the tape of Dan's arrest, which is not available to the public defender's office for whatever reason. It's more interesting the fact that, you know, Dan was seen by a psychiatrist, and the issue of competency was never raised, and a second psychiatrist interviews him, and now that psychiatrist is saying that Dan is incompetent to stand trial after allegedly offering him to take some sort of a plea deal. Just a lot of different – the incompetence of the public defender's office. And you know what? This is not like any public defender's office in any major city. I mean – it's not so much a conspiracy. It's more along the lines of you know, public defenders just do not have the resources that you would get if you have a private attorney, if you have that type of money and whatnot. So, you know, Dan does want to go to trial, and I understand that. And, you know, we'll have to see if that ever happens.
Absolutely. And what's really bad for him is you know, since they proved him to be incompetent, it'll be even longer before he can even try to get out of jail, out of prison.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. Who knows what the next step is. All right, with that said, we're going to go to David Levin now. David and I are going to be co-hosting a special edition of Carson's Corner in conjunction with Speak Your Mind Radio tomorrow at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. David, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. You're low, but I can hear you.
Good evening.
All right. How are you doing?
How are you doing, gentlemen? Yes. Okay. I just wanted to just mention about the case of Phoenix Golden. I mean, the family does believe that she still is alive, and she is a black female. She's currently age 25 now. She's 5'6" and she's 125 pounds. Her hair color description and facial hair is reddish-brown. She has pierced ears, brown eyes, and she was last seen in St. Louis, Missouri. Now, her car was found 25 minutes from her home on 9th Street in Clay Avenue. The last known location for her was St. Louis, Missouri, and there was another person that disappeared 500 miles apart, and the media did report a possible connection in that. But the person of interest that in the Stacey English case was eliminated, and Stacey English was found January 23rd, 2012, under a tree in a heavily wooded area near the Aaron's Amphitheater at Lakewood. But it's been 1 year and 11 months and 22 days tomorrow that Phoenix is still missing. And she went missing December 18th at about 3 p.m. in the driveway of her family's St. Louis County, Missouri home. And then roughly 3 hours later, Colden's black 1998 Chevy Blazer was impounded by police after it was discovered about 25-minute drive from her home at 9th Street in St. Clair. The keys were in the ignition with the motor running, and the driver's door was unlocked, and this was the same thing that happened with Stacey English. And Lawrence will be talking about her disappearance and things that has happened since her disappearance. And, of course, in Tabitha Franklin, who has been missing since August 8th of 2009. And I have Stacey Darden White, who is the sister-in-law of Tabitha, on the line right now. So I will let her go ahead and speak a little bit, just giving a little bit of about this case here.
Okay. Hi, Stacey.
Tabitha actually went missing on August 13th, 2009. She was last seen at a friend's house in West Point. She was at a party there, and it was said that her ex-boyfriend, Chris Poor Merrill, came and picked her up from that place, and he told the police that he dropped her off at his place of business in Hueytown. This would have been approximately 10:30 to 1 o'clock in the morning that he would have been dropping her off at that place of business and supposedly going to run errands. So since then, we've had trouble getting the police to actively search in places that we felt needed to be searched, and we felt like the home that she was last at should have been searched, the car that he allegedly picked her up in should have been searched, and the place of business should have been searched, which the place of business was searched, but only after 3 months of me begging the police and them flipping over our jurisdictions of whose case it would be, and also me asking the landlord for permission for the police to go in and search. So we're just, you know, holding out hope that, you know, we can get her name out there and get people to pay attention to her case, you know, and give it a little bit more light.
Well, we really look forward to having you on the show tomorrow so that we can really explore this case in depth and really help to raise awareness to keep this in the spotlight, because I know it's very difficult as a family member to get sometimes it's difficult to get the proper spotlight that needs to be shed on a case like this. And I have a lot of questions too, and I know David will have a lot of questions too about the investigation and about where we go here forward. So it's going to be great having you on the show tomorrow, and hopefully we can all help to raise awareness on this case.
Thank y'all so much. Thank y'all for doing that.
You are welcome. I mean, I've been following this case. We've been in contact since, 2011? Was it 2010 or 2011 when you were on Kinsley's show?
I believe that was 2011.
Yeah. So, like I say, and I mean, hearing this, it's really, God has put this on my heart to really try to help out with this case and get this, what we can do. And hopefully also be able to at least get her home to at least have a proper burial, and Chris at least questioned.
Right.
Yeah, that to me is, I just, it's really mind-boggling. And a lot of times with these cases, David does this really full time, and David works a lot more closely with the families than I do. But one theme that I hear from family members that have missing relatives is just sometimes an uncooperation on the part of the police force, or just a lack of effort. I'm not saying that's what happened in this case. I don't know the circumstances, but it just sometimes it can make it that much more difficult for the families out there. We've got about 90 seconds left here, David. Just tell people where they could find the show tomorrow, and just kind of wrap it up, if you would.
Well, yeah, it's actually going to be at blogtalkradio.com / Carson's Corner. And the show will be starting at 6 o'clock, and it's going to be for 2 hours. And like I say, we'll be joined by Stacey Darden, who you just heard. and Phoenix Lawrence Colden, the father of missing Phoenix Colden, who has been missing since the 18th of December of 2011. And there's going to be a lot of interesting points in this that he brings up that has happened in this case. How both cars, I mean, like I say, it's there is, you know, excuse me. There are similarities with this case with the Stacey, with the Stacey English case, but they don't want to, like I said in that intro, that they still believe that she is alive and out there somewhere.
Well, we look forward to speaking with you, David, and you, Stacey, tomorrow. It should be a very, very good show and very informative, and hopefully someone out there will have some sort of information and can point the authorities and so on in the right direction. So thank you very much for joining us here tonight, and we'll speak to both of you tomorrow.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Take care. Justin, yeah. We're just about out of time here. Give people your Facebook page and any other way that they can keep in contact with you.
Okay, Facebook and Twitter, Justin Ray Harvey, and email is frankdukesfan@gmail.com.
Perfect, and my Facebook is facebook.com/BobCarsonMMA, and you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/BobCarsonMMA. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, show some respect. Take care.
Take care, Bob.